You're listening to The Average Time. I'm Pooh.
And I'm William Cooper.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, I got to apologize to you folks for our delayed airtime. I don't know what went wrong here, but our equipment was playing the cues and the lead-in at about 500 miles an hour. It's never done that before. I don't know why it did it. I don't even know how it did it. I'm just thankful that we're here, and everything seems to be working now. Don't go away. I'll be right back. Gentlemen, the United Nations flag is flying in Gainesville, Florida again over the courthouse. Now, in 1994, I made a plea to the American people to help us toss the UN flag out, bring it down, and discredit the United Nations Association in Gainesville, and we were successful. We did it. But they haven't learned the lesson. Another flag is flying now, so I'm going to ask you to do the same thing again. Call the Gainesville city manager, tomorrow. And keep calling until the flag comes down. The Gainesville City Manager's number is 904-334-2011. That's 904-334-2011. Tell them we don't care if it's the 50th anniversary of the United Nations. It has nothing to do with us whatsoever. The Assistant City Manager is 904-334-2220. So for the rest of the numbers, I'm going to read you. It's 904-334, so I'm just going to read the last four digits. Assistant City Manager, 2220. The Deputy City Manager, 2011. That's the Deputy City Manager, 2011. The City Commission, 2006. That's the City Commission, 2006. Now, folks, a very nice ceremony took place in Oklahoma City today, and nothing to do with the bombing, nothing whatsoever to do with the bombing. Had to do with something entirely different. This is a report from our people in Oklahoma City. I want to read it verbatim because it's very well written. At 6 p.m. this evening, approximately 30 members of the Oklahoma Militia, the Oklahoma Freedom Network, the Citizens Agency for Joint Intelligence, the Intelligence Service, and representatives from two branches of the John Birch Society met on the south steps of the Oklahoma State Capitol in Oklahoma City to burn the United Nations flag in protest of the 50th anniversary of that organization, criminal organization, if you will, attempting to destroy the sovereignty of all the nation states. Prior to the event, one of the organizers met with Capitol Police to obtain a permit to hold the small rally on the Capitol steps. He was asked what he wanted to do during the rally and told the police officer that the group intended to burn a flag. This didn't seem to bother the police any, although it at first raised a few eyebrows. The officer then asked which flag was being burned. When he explained that the United Nations flag was to be burned, huge grins spread across the faces of the officers in the permit department. Thumbs went up around the room. One officer said, "Hurrah!" And the officer issuing the permit smiled broadly, saying, quote, "Right on," end quote, as he handed over the rally permit. Although every local television and radio station in the metro area had received advance notice of the event, only KWTV Channel 9 sent a lone cameraman to cover the protest. Bill Bauer, one of the organizers of Oklahoma Freedom Network, was briefly interviewed during the noon newscast on KTOK Radio about the protest against the United Nations. But the tone of the interview gave the impression that Mr. Bauer and his organization were laughable but harmless kooks. The media was not going to take this seriously, if they even reported it at all, which is the standard procedure for the communist news networks. And I don't care where they are, how little or big they are. If they're not telling the truth, they're the communist news networks, even in Oklahoma City. When I telephoned KFOR Channel 4 television in the late morning to make sure they knew about the protest, they said they knew about it, but were not interested in covering it. The media did everything possible to ignore the event and went out of their way to make sure that no announcements were made to inform the public about the protest. In speaking with the people present, most had heard about the flag burning from friends, or friends of friends. And those who took the time to come did so because they wanted to make a personal stand against the United Nations and everything evil that it represents. And prior to the formal opening of the brief ceremony, all participants were given a printed copy of the United Nations logo, over which was superimposed the universal no symbol. These papers would be used as kindling for the burning of the United Nations flag at the appropriate moment.
Shortly after 6 o'clock, as we huddled closely in the lengthening shadows of the trees around the Capitol building, shivering in a cold 35-mile-an-hour northwest wind, the meeting was officially called to order. Throughout the ceremony, a large American flag was flying, held by a member of the Oklahoma Freedom Network. All recited the Pledge of Allegiance. A member of the Oklahoma militia offered a prayer. And then another member addressed the group and the Channel 9 news cameraman, explaining why we were gathered together at that time and in that place. One of the members explained that similar ceremonies had been taking place all over the country, some yesterday, some today, and that patriots were gathering in many states to demonstrate against the United Nations and to support Specialist Michael New, who had refused to wear the United Nations insignia on his Army uniform and was facing court-martial because of his stand. Copies of 1994's Oklahoma House Resolution number 1047 were handed out to those present, entitled U.S. Military Forces Under UN Authority, Opposition Memorializing Congress, in which the Oklahoma House of Representatives had taken a stand against the presence of the United Nations of the United States military in United Nations operations, and memorializing the United States Congress to cease providing funding for military operations not authorized by Congress, to cease participation in military activities under United Nations authority, to cease rendering aid to any activity under United Nations jurisdiction, and to cease support for the establishment of a new world order or any form of global government. Members of the Oklahoma Freedom Network collected signatures on petitions which will be presented to the Oklahoma State Legislature next February, when the confirmation hearings will begin concerning Bob Rick's appointment by Governor Frank Keating to serve as the head of the Oklahoma State Department of Public Safety. Many signatures have already been collected from the southwestern part of the state where Oklahoma Freedom Network is headquartered, and those signing wished to make it known that they do not want Bob Rick's brand of law enforcement in our state. At the present time, Bob Ricks has already taken his place as the head of the Public Safety Department, having retired from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. But until the February confirmations take place, Mr. Ricks has not been officially accepted in that position. But for those of you who may not, by some fluke of absolute and total ignorance or memory loss, not know who Bob Ricks is, he's one of the people responsible for the Waco massacre. Because of the high winds and dry conditions, a burn ban had been issued this morning against all outdoor burning. But because the Capitol Police were in favor of burning the United Nations flag, and because a metal container was provided which would hold the burning flag, and appropriately, it was a garbage can, the burn ban was overlooked for this ceremony. As cries of death to the New World Order and down with the United Nations echoed across the plaza steps in front of the Capitol, the United Nations flag was doused with paint thinner and set ablaze as all participants threw their printed United Nations symbols into the flames. The flag curled, shriveled, and crumbled miserably, pathetically, and pitifully into ash. All cheered. As is the custom at these meetings, the speaker's platform, called the soapbox, was made available for anyone wishing to speak. Brief words were offered honoring the fathers or husbands who had served and bled for our country, concluding that the United Nations was an insult and an affront to their sacrifice. The crowd was reminded that the Conference of States issue was not yet dead, and that even as we spoke, meetings were quietly being held in the Omni Netherlands Plaza Hotel in Cincinnati, Ohio, where organizers hoped the Conference of States proposals could be resurrected. All were encouraged to keep their ears tuned to the shortwave radio. The Hour of the Time was vigorously promoted because the mainstream press has been keeping very quiet about the Cincinnati meeting and what is happening there. The folks present were encouraged to go back to their areas, organize their people, and continue vigorously protesting against the Conference of States. We stopped it once, and it can be stopped again. The Oklahoma militia was discussed, and a brief explanation of the militia was given. The organizations present made known the times and places of their monthly meetings, and phone numbers and addresses were exchanged. The John Birch Society provided copies of the latest issue of The New American, and members spoke briefly about educational materials available from the Society. Now, folks, I don't have anything against the John Birch Society. In fact, I encourage membership. They have an awful lot of educational materials, and they do a lot of educating. But I take great issue with their stance that their members should not participate in anything other than the vote. If everybody in this nation really believes that baloney and participates only in the vote, the New World Order will come much quicker than anyone ever dreamed. And its influence will be much more cruel, I can assure you. The vote is always rigged. Doesn't matter who you vote for. By the time there are two clear candidates opposing each other, they both belong to the other side, ladies and gentlemen. In most, not all instances, but most. Anyone in this country today who believes that you are going to change anything in the future strictly by the vote today isn't playing with a full deck of cards. Or maybe you've taken a hint from Rush Limbaugh and you're sitting on half your brain. Or maybe you bent over the toilet and accidentally flushed it down. I don't know. But the vote is no longer the answer. Ladies and gentlemen, it should be clear. The last election should have made it clear. What's happening in the country today should make it crystal clear. Clinton is going to run unopposed, ladies and gentlemen. And the conservative vote is going to be fractured into 5 million pieces. As if it made any difference anyway. And you have people running that you're slathering all over for, who have given their oath of allegiance to foreign powers and secret societies and other agendas, most of which you're not even remotely aware of. I continue. The United Nations flag having been burned, and with everyone freezing in the twilight, the meeting was adjourned and the people dispersed. It was a peaceful, orderly gathering attended by but a few dedicated souls who really care about the state of the nation and the preservation of our freedoms. And there would have been many more had it been publicized, but it was not. The day may come when the couch potatoes find themselves being served for dinner, along with the sheeple, who have become steaks on the table by choice and consent. As is always the case, those very few who give with the greatest commitment of heart will be the ones who will fight to restore our greatest way of life, liberty. It is ever thus. The numbers don't matter. This afternoon's ceremony was a symbolic act, but solid patriots need not fear that their small stands on principle automatically mean small results. When the commitment and dedication is high, and when passion energizes the courage of conviction, a few good men and women can overcome any enemy whose only motivation is a paycheck and obedience to the state. God bless you. Signed, Michelle.
Father.
those of you who were not listening Friday night, maybe you were out on a date or took your wife to dinner, or maybe you took your boyfriend or husband to dinner, or maybe the propagation was so bad that you just couldn't hear the broadcast, I encourage you to order the tape. Tonight is part two. And I believe, ladies and gentlemen, that this is extremely important information that everyone needs to know. It's from a book entitled Freemasonry and Catholicism, which was printed both here in the United States and in England in 1919 by the Rosicrucian Fellowship. And the Rosicrucian Fellowship is just another branch of the same old Illuminati at the highest levels, and at the same lower levels, it is basically a carbon copy of all of the rest of them. There's an interesting history behind the Rosicrucian Fellowship, the AMORC, the Ancient Order of the Rose and Cross, and they have several other names. It has to do with the Knights Templar and the Merovingian line of kings in France. But anyway, let me continue with part two tonight of this illuminating text. The Masonic legend is voluminous, circumstantial, even trivial, and seemingly far-fetched and fantastic to the uninitiated who fail to see the important hidden meaning underlying every word. But we will give only such fragments as have a bearing upon our main subject and the explanation necessary to link them together. The events which led up to the conspiracy against the Grand Master Hiram Abiff, mentioned on Friday night, and which culminated in his murder, commenced with the arrival of the Queen of Sheba, who had been attracted to the court of Solomon by tales of his wonderful wisdom and of the splendor of the temple he was engaged in building. She is said to have come laden with gorgeous gifts, and it is stated that at first she was much impressed with the wisdom of Solomon. But even the Bible, which is written from the standpoint of the Jehovistic hierarchies, hints that she saw at the court of Solomon one that was fairer than he. And there the Bible narrative leaves her. Her marriage with Solomon was never consummated, or the name of Mason would have faded from memory long ere the present day, and humanity at large would now be docile children of the dominant church without free will, choice, or prerogative. Nor could she be permitted to wed Hiram, who represented the temporal power, or religion would have been stamped out. She must wait for the bridegroom, who shall embody within himself the combined good qualities of Solomon and Hiram, but who is purified from their weaknesses. For the Queen of Sheba is the composite soul of humanity, and at the consummation of the work of our evolutionary era, she will be the bride, while Christ, whom Paul called a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, will fill the dual office of both spiritual and temporal head, where he will be both king and priest to the eternal welfare of mankind at large, who are now in bondage, either to church or state, but waiting, whether they realize it or not, for the day of emancipation, symbolically represented as the millennium, when there will be a wonderful city, a new Jerusalem, a city of peace. And the earlier this amalgamation can be brought about, the better for humanity. Therefore, an attempt was made at the time,
and in the place which is said in the legend to be the scene of Solomon's and Hiram's love episode. There the two initiatory orders met for the consummation of a definite work of amalgamation symbolically called the Molten Sea, a work which was then attempted for the first time. It could not have been wrought at any earlier period, for man was not sufficiently advanced at that time. However, it seemed as if the united efforts of the two schools might accomplish the task. And had it not been for the desire of each to oust the other from the affections of the symbolic Queen of Sheba, the soul of humanity, they might have succeeded. An equitable union between church and state, the cross in the crown, might have been effected, and human evolution might have been greatly furthered. But both church and state were jealous of their particular prerogative. The church would only amalgamate upon condition that she retain all her ancient power over mankind, and take in addition those of the temporal government. The state was selfish in a similar manner, and the Queen of Sheba, humanity at large, is still unwed. The Masonic legend tells the story of the attempt and its failure as follows. But first, ladies and gentlemen, we have a little business to take care of. It's the half hour, which always comes around this time. Somewhere along the line in the last 3.5 or a little more years, you've all began to understand what it is that's coming about. And I hope you begin to shelter that which you have. I'm not talking about things that are easily lost. And I'm not talking about things that you owe so much money on that you're not going to pay it off in 30 years. I'm talking about what you have, what you really own, and what you can keep from squandering from your paycheck each week or every 2 weeks or each month. You see, we have a method whereby you can place some of your assets into real money, gold or silver coin, or any of the precious metals in any of their numerous forms. And I hope that you have either begun to take advantage of that, or you have taken advantage of that, or you are in the process of taking advantage of it. But in case you have not, or you have not completed the business that you need to take care of, I urge you to call Swiss America Trading. Tell them you're a listener to the Hour of the Time, and that you want a copy of the most current newsletter. It's always filled with information jam-packed that you need to know. You'll get red carpet VIP treatment, I guarantee it. Ask them to discuss with you how you can take advantage of all the different ways, or maybe just one of the different ways by which you can obtain non-reportable, non-confiscatable hard assets that will have the same value 100 years from now that they did 100 years ago and that they do today. 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. 1-800-BUY-COIN. And while you're at it, folks, thank them for sponsoring the Hour of the Time. You know, if for some reason you did not hear Friday's broadcast, you are belaboring to understand what's going on tonight. You see, I laid the groundwork for this, and tonight is laying the groundwork for what's going to come tomorrow night. And then that will lay the groundwork for the night after. This is really a continuation of our Mystery Babylon series, and it's extremely important that you understand what this is all about. So if you did not hear Friday's broadcast, you must order the tape or you're lost. And you're not going to catch up, because that explained the whole foundation upon which all the rest is to follow in this series. So if you would like to have a copy of that tape, send $10. If you're not a member, the price is $10. If you are a member, either of CAGI or the Intelligence Service, the price is $8. Make sure you include your membership number with your order, so that we can make sure that you get the proper service. Make check or money order payable to Annie, A-N-N-I-E, and send it to the Intelligence Service, Post Office Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. And don't worry if you can't spell Sholo, because it's the zip code that counts. And we're not worried about all that crap that says you're not something if you are, if you use a zip code, because that's a bunch of bullshit. Okay, folks? I now continue. When the Queen of Sheba had been shown the gorgeous palace of Solomon and had bestowed her choice gifts of gold and wrought work, she asked also to be shown the great temple, which was nearing completion. She marveled much at the magnitude of the work, but wondered at the seeming absence of workmen and the stillness about the place. And she therefore requested Solomon to call the workmen, that she might see who had wrought this wonder. But though the servants of Solomon at the palace obeyed the slightest wish of the monarch, and although he had been appointed by the god Jehovah to build the temple,
These workmen were not subject to his authority. They only yielded obedience to one who had the word and the sign. Therefore, no one appeared at the call of Solomon, and the Queen of Sheba could not escape the conclusion that this marvelous miracle was wrought by another and one who was greater than Solomon. And so she insisted on knowing and seeing the king of crafts and his wonderful workmen, much to the chagrin of Solomon, who felt that he had fallen in her estimation. The Temple of Solomon is our solar universe, which forms the great school of life for our evolving humanity. The broad lines of its history, past, present, and future, are written in the stars, its main outlines being discernible to anyone of average intelligence. In the microcosmic scheme, the Temple of Solomon is also the body of man, wherein the individualized spirit, or ego, is evolving, as God is in the great universe. Work on the true temple, as we are told in 2 Corinthians 5th chapter, is wrought by invisible forces working in silence, building the temple without sound or hammer. As the Temple of Solomon was visible in all its glory to the Queen of Sheba, so the evidence of the toil of these invisible forces is easily perceived, both in the universe and in man. But they themselves keep in the background and work without ostentation. They hide from all who have not the right to see them or to command them. The relation of these nature forces to the work they do in the universe may perhaps be better understood when we use an illustration. Let us suppose that a carpenter wishes to build a house wherein to live. He selects a place whereon to build and brings the material thither. Then, with the tools of his trade, he commences to lay the foundation. Gradually, the walls are put up, the roof put on, the inside completed, and the structure finished. During all the time while he is working, a dog, which is an intelligent spirit belonging to another and later life wave of evolution, watches his actions in the whole process of construction and sees the house gradually take shape and reach completion, but it lacks the proper understanding of what he is doing and of what is the ultimate purpose in his mind. Let us now suppose that the dog were unable to see the carpenter or to hear the noise made by his hammer and other tools. Then it would be in the same relation to this builder as humanity at large is to the architect of the universe and the forces which work under his command. For the dog would then see only the materials coming together slowly and taking shape, finally forming a finished structure. Humanity also sees the silent growth of plant, of beast, and of bird, but is unable to understand what causes this physical growth and the changes in the visible universe. For it does not see the immense army of invisible workmen who are silently toiling in the soundless silence to bring about these results, nor do they respond to the call of anyone who has not the sign and the word of power, no matter how high his standing or station in the world. The churchman always emphasizes the necessity of faith, while the statesman emphasizes and places his reliance on work. But when faith flowers into work, we reach the highest ideal of expression. Humanity may and does admire lofty sentiment and brilliant oratory. But when a Lincoln unbinds the shackles of a downtrodden race, or when a Luther revolts in behalf of the fretted spirits of humanity and secures religious freedom for them, the outward action of these emancipators reveals a beauty of soul never discernible in those who soar in cloud land, but fear to soil their hands by actual work on the temple of humanity. The latter are not true temple builders and would be unable to gain inspiration from the sight of that wonderful temple described by Manson in, quote, "The Servant in the House," end quote. The author calls him man's son. This may mean that he regards him as the son of man, but it may also be that he meant mason, for the servant in the house was also a temple builder. It is wonderful what insight the author of the play must have had when he planned the scene where his servant, the workman in love with his work, tells the worldly-minded churchman, who is full of platitudes and as vile as a whited sepulcher, of the temple which he, the workman, built. This conception is a mystic gem, and we append it for the reader's meditation. Quote, "I am afraid you may not consider it an altogether substantial concern. It has to be seen in a certain way under certain conditions. Some people never see it at all. You must understand that this is no dead pile of stones and unmeaning timber. It is a living thing. When you enter it, you hear a sound as of some mighty poem chanted. Listen long, and you will learn that it is made up of the beating of human hearts, of the nameless music of men's souls. That is, if you have ears. If you have eyes, you will presently see the church itself, a looming mystery of many shapes and shadows, leaping sheer from floor to dome, the work of no ordinary builder. The pillars of it go up like the brawny trunks of heroes. The sweet human flesh of men and women is molded about its bulwarks. Strong, impregnable, the faces of little children laugh out from every cornerstone. The terrible spans and arcs of it are the joined hands of comrades. And up in the heights and spaces are inscribed the numberless musings of all the dreamers in the world. It is yet building, building and built upon. Sometimes the work goes forward in deep darkness, sometimes in blinding light. Now beneath the burden of unutterable anguish, now to the tune of great laughter and heroic shoutings, like the cry of thunder. Sometimes, in the silence of the night, one may hear the tiny hammerings of the comrades at work in the dome, the comrades that have gone aloft. It is such a temple that the mystic mason is building. He endeavors to work on the temple of humanity at large. But since, and I quote, when the rose adorns itself, it adorns the garden, he aims also to cultivate his own spiritual powers as foreshadowed in the molten sea. Solomon had already sued for the hand of the Queen of Sheba and had been accepted. So feeling that the meeting with Hiram Abiff might change her affections, he endeavored to consummate their marriage before granting her wish to meet the Grand Master. The queen was obstinate. She sensed the grandeur of the master workman whose skill had wrought the marvelous temple, and she felt intuitively drawn towards this man of action, as she had never been moved by the wisdom of Solomon, which only found verbal expression in flowery speeches and high ideals which he was unable to carry into realization. Therefore, the reluctance of Solomon to let her meet Hiram Abiff made the queen all the more anxious and importunate, so that at last Solomon was forced to accede to her request and he grudgingly sent for the Grand Master. When Hiram Abiff appeared and Solomon saw the love light kindle in the eyes of the Queen of Sheba, jealousy and hatred took root in his heart. He was, however, too wise to betray his feelings. But from that moment, the plan of reconciliation and amalgamation of the sons of Seth and the sons of Cain, which had been mapped out by the divine hierarchies, was doomed to failure, wrecked upon the rocks of jealousy and self-seeking. The Queen of Sheba, according to the Masonic legend, then requested Hiram Abiff to show her the workman on the temple. The Grand Master struck a nearby rock with his hammer, so that the fire sparks flew, and at the sign of fire, coupled with the work of power,
the toilers of the temple flocked around their master in a great multitude, which no one could count, all ready and anxious to do his bidding. And this spectacle so impressed the Queen of Sheba with the wonderful power of this man that she determined to jilt Solomon and win the heart of Hiram Abiff. In other words, humanity, when its eyes are opened to the impotence of the churchmen, the sons of Seth, who are themselves dependent upon divine favor, and when it sees the power and potency of the rulers of temporal fame, is then ready to rush to them and leave the spiritual for the material. This from the microcosmic angle of the matter. From the cosmic angle, our viewpoint, we note again that Solomon's temple is the solar universe, and Hiram Abiff, the Grand Master, is the sun which travels around the 12 signs of the zodiac, enacting there the mystic drama of the Masonic legend. At the vernal equinox, the sun leaves the watery sign Pisces, which is also feminine and docile, for the belligerent and martial, energetic, fiery sign Aries, the ram, or lamb, where it is exalted in power. It fills the universe with a creative fire which is immediately seized upon by the innumerable billions of nature spirits who therewith build the temple of the coming year in forest and fen. The forces of fecundation applied to the countless seeds slumbering in the ground causes them to germinate and fill the earth with luxuriant vegetation, while the group spirits mate the beasts and birds in their charge so that they may bring forth and increase sufficiently to keep the fauna of our planet at normal. And those of you in those few sentences may have recognized the lyrics of a song that I play quite frequently on this broadcast. According to the Masonic legend, Hiram Abiff, the Grand Master, used a hammer to call his workmen, and it is significant that the symbol of the sign Aries, where this wonderful creative activity commences, is shaped like a double ram's horn, which also resembles a hammer. It is also worthy of notice that in the ancient Norse mythology, the Vanir, or water deities, are said to have been conquered by the Æsir, or fire gods. The hammer, wherewith the Norse god Thor struck fire from the sky, finds its counterpart in the thunderbolt of Jove. Like Hiram, the Æsir belong to the hierarchy of fire, the Lucifer spirits, the sons of Cain, striving for positive mastership through individual effort, and therefore upholding the male ideal, the phallus, the obelisk, the generative force, thought, desire, action, which is dramatically opposite to that of the hierarchy which works in the plastic element water. In the present-day temples of the latter order, magic water stands at the door, and all who enter are required to apply this lethal liquid to the point in the forehead where the spirit resides. Their reason is drowned in dictums and dogmas, and the female ideal is worshipped in the Virgin Mary. Faith is the prime factor in their salvation, the attitude of unquestioning childlike obedience being cultivated. It is different in the temple of the other order, when the candidate enters there poor, naked, and blind. He is asked at once what he is seeking, and when he answers, light, it is the duty of the master to give what he asks and make him a free Mason, literally a child of light, or the sons of light. It is his duty also to teach him to work, and a male ideal, Hiram Abiff, the master workman, is presented for emulation. He is taught to be always ready to give a reason for his faith. As he qualifies in the work, he rises step by step, and at each degree, more light is given. There are 3 times 3 degrees in the lesser mysteries, When the candidate has passed the ninth arc, he is in the Holy of Holies, which forms the gate to greater fields beyond the scope of Masonry. For further elucidation of that subject, the student is referred to the chapters of initiation, volcanic eruption in the number 9 in the Rosicrucian Cosmo conception. Advancement and promotion in mystic Masonry is not dependent on favor. It cannot be given till it has been earned, and the candidate has stored in himself the power to rise any more than a pistol can be fired till it has been loaded. Initiation is merely like pulling the trigger and consists in showing the candidate how to use the power latent within himself. There were some among the workmen on the temple who thought they ought to be promoted to a higher degree, but who had not the power within. Therefore, Hiram Abiff could not initiate them. And as they were unable to see that the lack was in themselves, they felt provoked at Hiram, as over-ambitious candidates of today feel slighted and stamp a spiritual teacher as a fraud who is unable to give them immediate illumination and induction into the invisible while they are still eating of the flesh pots of Egypt, and unwilling to sacrifice themselves upon the altar of self-denial. The dissatisfied among Hiram's men entered into a conspiracy to spoil his great masterpiece, The Molten Sea. And ladies and gentlemen, we will continue tomorrow night when we begin the casting of The Molten Sea. Remember, the soul or the rose cannot perfect itself until it has been sacrificed upon the cross of life. Now, it makes no difference whether you believe this or you don't believe it, but I will tell you that those who are bringing the great changes in the world today believe every word of it. And so it matters not whether you believe it or not, whether you care about it or not, whether you laugh at it, or whether you take it seriously. It will affect you. And if you do not know it, and if you do not understand it, and you stand in its way, you will surely be struck down. You cannot fight a battle if you do not know your enemies. I'll tell you right now, it's all total, utter, and complete bullshit. It is the method of deceiving those in the lower levels so that they may be controlled through the process of the degrees of initiation. Then it weeds out those who cannot be trusted and allows only those who can to reach the highest levels. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. Don't miss tomorrow night. And God bless you all.